Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. This weekend, Pope Benedict XVI travels to Italy's northwestern coast, a region bordering with France, known as Liguria. More specifically, he goes to the cities of Savona and Genoa. Meanwhile, I'd like to set the ground for this visit by sharing with you stories connected to a couple of popes linked to this coastal area. The first pope is Pius VII, whose rooms Benedict XVI is scheduled to visit in Savona in the city's bishop's residence on Saturday, 17th of May. A pope, then, who was not linked to this town of his own will. As we know, Pius VII was arrested one sweltering July night, 1809, as he rested in his residence at the Quirinal Palace here in Rome, and forced into exile, first to France, and then a month later precisely to Savona, where he was to stay for three long years. When finally that very man who had banished him from Rome, annexing the papal states to his empire, was forced into exile himself. As you're bound to have guessed, this man was Napoleon, an emperor whose coronation Pope Pius VII had once presided over. Stay tuned as I tell the story with the help of a famous painting. It was a bitterly cold day of December 1804 when Napoleon was crowned Emperor of the French. There was pomp and circumstance, music composed for the occasion by Paisiello, a mass and a Te Deum for two choirs and two orchestras. Le Sueur composed a march, the one we're listening to right now. The ceremony French artist Jacques-Louis David famously immortalised, taking liberties in the placing. They say that a handsome bribe would get you a prime spot. There were even figures painted in who did not attend, like Napoleon's own mother, for example. Others had natural pride of place. Others, like Pius VII, who in this masterpiece appears the closest to Napoleon. Although, according to documents written by the master of ceremonies of the time, Pius VII's role in the presiding of this ceremony was not exactly as he'd expected. His was a role limited to blessing of crowns and other such regalia, not to the actual crowning. This was a solo act by Napoleon, who, as rumour has it, grabbed the crown from the Pope's own hands. Unusually crowning himself. That's before proceeding to crown his wife, Josephine. In the David painting, in fact, we see him as he's about to crown his wife with the Charlemagne crown as she kneels in front of him, as he dons his personal golden laurel wreath crown. I must say, I wondered about the presence of a Roman pontiff at a ceremony like this, so far away from Rome. Thinking it unusual, I asked a liturgist to comment on Pius VII's presence there. He's Jesuit Keith Peckles, who's currently teaching at the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome.
I mean, normally emperors would be crowned, we think of Charlemagne, for example, would have been crowned in Rome, and there was a whole reason for that. In many cases, it was to try to...
In St. Peter's.
And the reason was, of course, to show the close connection to Rome, the place of Peter and of Paul, and the link between the emperor and the pope, or the link between the empire and the See of Peter. So there was a logical sort of connection between the city of Rome and the crowning taking place in Rome. Of course, the French situation is a bit different. We have, you know, you have places like France and even certain times in Spain where bishops were being named by the emperor. The history is rich in terms of that dynamic. And we also know, of course, popes were itinerant at various points in their history. Enough to think of Avignon, for example, going back some centuries. But it was unusual, but it wasn't completely uncommon that popes would also be found outside of Rome, and that kind of event might take place outside of the city of Rome.
No doubt, while in exile in Savona, Pius VII must have often thought back to that coronation ceremony. But as I said earlier, his exile eventually came to an end in 1814. And in June 1914, even the New York Times wrote that the Catholic Church celebrated with fervour a century since the return to Rome of Pius VII. Curiously, the man who became Pope exactly a century since Pius VII's return to Rome was another Roman pontiff linked to Benedict XVI's visit to this part of the world. In this case, Genoa. He's the last of the four popes who were natives of this city. And as we know, it was he who, in part, inspired our present Holy Father to take the name Benedict. Born in Genoa, the future Benedict XV, Giacomo della Chiesa, was not brought up in a particularly Catholic milieu. Genoa, in fact, was not an especially Catholic city, but a great port city with a proud past as an independent republic right until 1799. One considered as both radical and tumultuous, and remarkable for having given birth to the explorer Christopher Columbus, and then to Giuseppe Mazzini, the ideologue and leader of the Italian democratic nationalist movement. But getting back to Benedict XV, the Pope who is best known perhaps for his attempts in encouraging peace initiatives and humanitarian ventures, it's perhaps time to find out more about him. So if you stay tuned, in a few moments I'll be bringing you some very personal impressions of this Pope from Genoa. One Benedict XVI is bound to mention on Sunday 18th when he goes there. So get ready to step back in time for some sound from my archives on the popes of the 20th century and watch the change of pace and tone as I share with you excerpts from experts on the figure of this Pope, as well as the witness of some of the people who lived through that particular era.
I had come to Rome from London, in fact, because my father was a diplomat and was in London when the war broke out and was called up and then wounded at Gallipoli and then posted here. And my mother joined him with my nanny, who was
a... Father John Charleroux was only a child in those days, but he remembered the Roman scene very clearly. Children, he told me, are very sensitive to atmospheres.
In those times, the Italian capital was very much keeping the Vatican in the background. One didn't speak much of the Vatican. We had family connections with the black people, the people of the Vatican, but one knew that it wasn't in keeping with the new mode. The relations between the black aristocracy, all, even the priests, and the Italian state were... Well, it was incompatible to have to make the mix. For instance, my mother told me about an occasion where they were invited to a ball at the embassy of Argentine to the Holy See. They were dining.
The lavish ball at the Argentinian embassy to the Holy See, Father Charleroux told me about, took place during the latter years of Pope Benedict XV's pontificate, shortly after the end of the First World War.
Well, come with us. My father and mother were invited, and they all went. And when one of the guests entered that Argentine embassy, which was in Palazzo Cencibrone, there was as if the devil had appeared in the room. It was because among those guests of Countess Lovatelli was one of the sons of Garibaldi. And he didn't know where his hostess was leading him. When he noticed that he was in the Argentine embassy to the Holy See, he withdrew immediately. Nevertheless, the scandal was such that the ambassador had to be recalled by his government. So it gives you the tone of the relationship between the black world and the white world of the Savoys.
When Italy was made a kingdom, The Pope was deprived of his possessions and his sovereignty. And some Roman families who were devoted to him for centuries refused to join the new state of things, and they even closed the gates, the doors.
Count Carlo Cardelli belonged to one of those families who, from one generation to another, had served the popes. They were known as black families simply because the women who belonged to these families went to the Vatican court wearing black veils, while the Savoy families wore white veils.
In January sometime, as the representatives of the ancient nobility of the city of Rome, distinguishing them from the princely and feudal houses. My grandfather, Alessandro, went to in the Vatican gardens to keep company to the whole, to Pope Pius IX, as many other gentlemen from the Roman nobility did, and inform him about what was going on in the town and the society. And unfortunately, he doesn't refer in his diaries what the Pope told to him or what he did say to the Pope. But anyhow, the fact remains that the Pope was happy to receive news from the outside when he was a prisoner in the Vatican.
Contacts between the Vatican and the homes of the black aristocracy were frequent and familiar. While his grandfather told the count of his walks with Pope Pius IX in the Vatican Gardens back in 1876, his grandmother told him about young Monsignor della Chiesa, the future Pope Benedict XV's visits to his family home as a young diplomat. Can you remember anything about him?
Well, I know that as a Monsignore, he came to see my grandmother very frequently, and this he remembered when he saw one or the other from my family.
Can you remember any gossip that went round about him?
The Vatican chamberlains were called camerieri segreti. Secret means intimate. So once the Pope, Benedict XV, asked one of these camerieri segreti to comply with some very confidential task. And he said, remember that this must be a secret, because if you're not a secret, you will remain only a cameriere, a waiter.
The Count certainly picked up a little gossip about Pope Benedict XV, but had no knowledge of a legend about him keeping wolves in the Vatican Gardens.
I heard a rather curious story that Benedict kept two wolves in the Vatican garden. Now, I've talked to the family, the Della Chiesa family, and they say categorically that they don't remember this at all.
He said to her,
while the Della Chiesa family firmly denied this alleged eccentricity, they allowed Pope Benedict XV's biographer, John Pollard, access to family correspondence. John Pollard discovered a more human side to the seemingly rather misunderstood Pope.
Antonio was quite ill. I've read the correspondence which the Della Chiesa family have kept, and he was very close in terms of correspondence, very affectionate, very concerned about his family. I mean, there are some very interesting, very nice letters. He showed concern about the details of their lives, and particularly he was very concerned about his brother Giovanni Antonio, who sadly died shortly after he came to Rome. His predecessor, Pius X, used to have his sisters, all three of them, in the palace two or three times a week, and they used to have a glass of wine together, and they used to say the rosary together, and I imagine they had a good gossip together. Benedict XV was slightly more distant from his family, though his family did come to live in Rome. Curiously, he was very English. I mean, he was Genoese, and he had a very common, sensible approach to life.
This common-sense approach to life surfaced both at a political and a practical level during what was to be a wartime pontificate.
If I had to remember one thing about him, it would be that he tried to stop the First World War, and he tried repeatedly and persistently. He issued the famous peace note in August 1917. It was a peace plan for a negotiated peace without cessions of territory, without great reparations. It was basically an attempt to go back to the status quo. But above all, it was an attempt to stop the war. The other side of the coin of Benedict's trying to stop the war was a huge humanitarian effort which he made. I mean, he set up almost a second Red Cross in the Vatican, a prisoners of war bureau, searching for missing prisoners of war, literally thousands, and we're talking about thousands and thousands, bringing prisoners of war, particularly sick and wounded prisoners of war, civilian internees out of occupied countries, taking them to Switzerland, and providing prodigious amounts of money to relieve starvation in Germany because of the blockade, and also in Eastern Europe generally, including Armenia and parts of Russia. So, I mean, it was a quite extraordinary humanitarian effort that the Vatican conducted during the First World War.
Pope Benedict XV may have been more successful in his humanitarian efforts than in his peace efforts, but the political scene in those years was one of exasperated nationalism, as Father Charles Leroux explained.
We were rather passionately nationalist in those where the British called the German the Huns, the French called the German the Boche. There was a real kind of passion. And, of course, London and Rome were keen, it's always like that, on getting the Catholic propaganda system on their side. Alas, they forgot that the relations of France with the Vatican had not been good, all the fault being on the French side. The French governments were very not only anti-Catholic, anti-Christian, had suppressed all the religious orders, were persecuting the Catholic schools and so on. On the English side, well, Catholicism is not exactly the religion of the nation, but on our enemy's side, on the side of the empires, you had the great Catholic power, which was Austria-Hungary, and you had in the German Empire, nevertheless, some Catholic states, which were the Kingdom of Bavaria, the Kingdom of Saxony, all the Rhine Valley, and the relations with those powers were much more favorable to Christianity and Catholicism than was our side.
The war that Pope Benedict XV had fought so hard to stop finally ended 4 years into his pontificate, at the 11th hour of the 11th day of November 1918. All over Europe, people danced joyfully in the streets. Buses were driven at random through flag-waving crowds. In the Vatican, Pope Benedict XV rejoiced. His war pontificate was over. Since 1914, he'd written 3 encyclicals about peace, and while the young men who'd survived the horrors of war were returning home, he began writing another encyclical about the children who'd been victims of that great war. Meanwhile, Papal Rome came to life. In the various embassies to the Holy See, they'd almost doubled during the war years, dust was being removed from chandeliers in the ballrooms, invitations sent out, exclusively to the black aristocracy, of course. The Roaring Twenties were about to begin. I hope you enjoyed this program with sound put together from my own personal archives regarding the popes of the 20th century. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.